Ronald H. Coase was born in 1910 in a small suburb of London. It was perhaps an inauspicious beginning for a future Nobel Prize recipient.
I was born in a home which had no electricity, no telephone, no car, no local bus service, and washing was done in a big tub in the kitchen, made of brick, and it was heated with coal.
An only child, Coase found solace in solitary games of chess and in the books he borrowed regularly from the local library. As a young boy, he suffered a physical deficiency.
Because I had a weakness in my legs and had to wear irons on my legs, I went to a school for physical defectives where I have no real recollection of what I was taught. I don't think really we were taught anything, but I remember being taught basket weaving and wasn't very good at it.
At the age of 12, a year later than most of his peers, Coase began his formal education at the Kilburn Grammar School. And although it was rare at the time for a boy from the English working class to go from grammar school to university, Ronald Coase entered the London School of Economics in 1929, where he developed an interest in the study of business and law. In 1931, he was awarded a Castle Traveling Scholarship and spent the academic year in the United States interviewing executives from Ford Motor Company, General Motors, Union Carbide, and others about the organization of their companies. Coase had a question that was driving these interviews, a curiosity about why, in a free market system, companies were formed in the first place.
We were discussing the way in which businesses were controlled and their plans were made and all that sort of thing. On the other hand, Plant had told us all about the invisible hand and how the pricing system worked itself. And you didn't need any plans and so on. And what seems quite natural to me now, although it doesn't seem to have bothered many other people, here you had these two systems operating simultaneously, one within the firm of a little planned society, and on the other hand, relations between firms conducted through the market. And yet, according to the way people looked at it, the whole thing could have been done through the market.
In 1937, he published his ideas in an article entitled The Nature of the Firm, which introduced a crucial new concept to the study of economics, the idea of transaction costs. In essence, Coase showed that traditional microeconomic theory regarding firms was incomplete. Yet, it would be a long time before his views were widely accepted. In the early 50s, he migrated to America, first teaching at the University of Buffalo, then at the University of Virginia, and finally in 1961 at the University of Chicago, where he was also editor of the Journal of Law and Economics, where he published a number of authors who were concerned with issues of economic freedom. In 1960, he published a major study entitled The Problem of Social Cost, in which he found that property rights and transaction costs were the keys to understanding problems as diverse as environmental controls, the allocation of resources, and corporate regulation. His thinking in this area became known as the Coase Theorem. In 1991, Coase was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economic Science for his work in the discovery and clarification of the significance of transaction costs and property rights. Today, his ideas have found wide application beyond economics, extending to law, sociology, and political science. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Ronald Coase.
Now, let's go back. Before you got to America, there were obviously some key people at LSE who influenced and shaped the way in which you thought. And it was an extraordinary collection of individuals, a small department with many luminaries. And could you recall some of the people who taught you and the influences that they had on you?
Oh, the person who was most influential was Arnold Plant, who was a professor of commerce and whose interest was, oddly enough, in property. He wrote on copyrights and he wrote on patents, which was subjects that economists didn't usually write about. He had been in business beforehand, actually. He went into business and then decided to take some courses at LSE, but he took them in economic history, oddly enough. So he didn't take any courses in economics, although he did attend Cannon's lectures.
Mm-hmm. And who was Cannon?
Edwin Cannon was the professor of economics at the London School of Economics. Very different from the modern economist, you know, a man with a lot of common sense.
Poor fellow, right?
Well, it stood him in good stead and would help us a good deal if more people had it.
So you got the scholarship and you headed off to New York. And once you got there, the question was, where did you go? How did you plan your itinerary? And what did you hope to accomplish? And who were the people who influenced you while you were in the United States?
Well, I went to America with a definite question. And what seems quite natural to me now, although it doesn't seem to have bothered many other people, here you had these two systems operating simultaneously, one within the firm of a little planned society, and on the other hand, relations between firms conducted through the market. And yet, according to the way people looked at it, the whole thing could have been done through the market.
And so your question is, why do we have firms and what do they do?
That's right.
And how did you propose to attack that question?
Well, I went around asking people. Mainly when I was in America, I visited businesses and industrial plants and so on, and talked to businessmen.
Now, how did a 21-year-old man with an English accent manage to get appointments or interviews to speak with people fairly high up in business hierarchies in the United States, in Detroit, or wherever it was that you happened to go?
Well, you must realize at that time I was a socialist.
Oh, okay. Well, that would get you a lot of appointments, I suppose.
And I had contacts in England. A family friend was Ernest Bevin, who was General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union, which was the biggest trade union in England. And he had good contacts with business.
So, and you'd go into these rooms and you'd interview people? Did you sit down and take notes quite
no,
diligently?
I didn't.
Just talk?
No, I just talked. I got all sorts of answers, and I didn't know what the answer was, of course. I didn't know really what I was looking for.
And so how did this sort of slow infusion of information lead to your gradual retreat from socialism and an embracing of a more market-oriented economy?
I don't think this talking to businessmen had any effect on this, but gradually, and particularly after I got back to England, my socialist views sort of slipped away. What is interesting is that one can hold contradictory views without discomfort, and a lot of people have done that, including Abba Lerner, who believed very much in the market and was a firm socialist.
And he was one of your colleagues at LSE, right?
He was a fellow student, and I knew him and I liked him. And we got on very well together. We had very good discussions, although he ended up, a kind of socialist always. A believer in the possibility that a socialist system could reproduce the results of perfect competition.
And so you come back, and then the question is whether or not you're going to write this up. And how did this eventually take place? I take it this was the basis of the work that you did for the article on the nature of the firm.
That's right.
Which was cited in the Nobel citation.
My view on this question was more or less firmly fixed by the time I got back to America. So I must have...
Got back to America or from America?
From America. It must have been in the summer of 1932, because I know that I gave a lecture when I got to Dundee, where I got a job, which contained the whole argument of the nature of the firm.
Now, you said you were interested in the firm at the time that you were a socialist. The question is, what world events influenced this odd combination of interest in businesses on the one hand and centralized planning through socialism on the other?
Well, I was, in relation to the firm, I was thinking in terms of economic theory. But of course, at that time, what was happening in Russia was really terribly important to people.
There was also an English brand of socialism which had none of the powerful and terrible political effects of the Soviet system. Did that have much of an effect on you when you were writing and thinking about these things in the early and mid-30s?
It may have done, because at the London School of Economics, it had been founded by Sidney Webb and Bernard Shaw and others who were associated with the Fabian Society. And the Fabians were socialists, but attaining the socialism not by revolution.
And so what happens is you then write the theory of the firm, and perhaps what you ought to do now is sort of explain to people what elements you introduced into the equations that made the appearance of firms seem intelligible and sensible in the larger scheme of things, so that it now, instead of being an anomaly, becomes a sensible social response.
Well, it was the notion I introduced at that time of what has come to be called transaction costs, although I never used the phrase. There were costs of using the market. I talked about costs of marketing. I talked about, I can't remember, other things. But my idea was that if you enter into market transactions, it's an expensive thing to do. You have to find out who to transact with. You have to work out the terms. You had to monitor what had happened. You had to deal with disputes and so on. And so that it wasn't cheap to have a
system of exchange.
Exchange, that's right.
And the firm, well, that wasn't cheap either, right?
That's right.
And so what were the costs associated with running a firm?
Well, we talked about managerial costs and so on, but I don't think we went into it in great detail. Anyway, the essential idea was that you had to compare these two costs to know whether you should have a firm or not.
Managerial cost is against exchange cost.
That's right.
And since the ratio is not fixed in nature, where exchange costs were lower, you would tend to see market transactions. And when managerial costs were lower, you would tend to see firms operate, right?
Yes. And what we find is, in fact, that most people are employed within firms. Most of economic activity takes place within firms.
So there are fewer sort of spot transactions in markets and more employment relations.
That's right. You get the contracts between firms. And this is where the price mechanism operates.
Now, moving on for a moment, even in the era before World War II, when you were talking about the nature of the firms, clearly you had other things that you had to do as well. What were your other kinds of intellectual interests and duties?
Well, the nature of the firm had almost nothing to do with my duties. When I went to the London School of Economics in 1935.
This was after this tour at Liverpool, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, where I had to lecture on banking and finance, the subjects on which I knew actually nothing, which made it difficult for me and I suppose for the students. Anyway, I went on to the London School of Economics, and there my duties consisted in part of helping Plant in his work, but I also had to give lectures on the economics of public utilities.
And had you been trained in that in any way, shape, or form?
Not at all. I knew nothing about the subject. And the man who'd given the course before, a man called Batson, had gone to South Africa. And so I had this course. I pretty soon discovered that nobody knew anything about public utilities. So I began a series of historical studies of public utilities in Britain.
And which ones did you look at?
Looked at water, gas, electricity, the post office, broadcasting.
A huge portion of the economy, by the way, resides in these industries.
That's right.
And if you were to look at them, what were the sort of general conclusions you reached, say, when you talked about the gas industry or the electric industry?
Well, I studied how they priced and so on. I studied the regulation of entry. And one of the things I really want to write up sometime is the whole origin of the doctrine of the natural monopoly. Mm-hmm. Which emerged actually in water supply in England. And I have a lot of material on that. In water supply.
Oh, water supply, okay.
In there was competition between water companies in London in the early 19th century, as a result of which it was concluded that it would be better to have one company rather than several. A dubious conclusion, but the one that was reached and was actually written up by John Stuart Mill.
And what were the reasons for the unification of all these rival water companies that was given by the proponents of the system?
Oh, it was so much going to be so much cheaper to have companies, one company dealing with each district, you see.
So this was a very static model?
That's right. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the whole point of competition is not to decide what to do at a given point of time, but is concerned with the introduction of new products and new methods of distribution and so on. And these you found, actually, during the competition. One doesn't realize that the quality of water can be so changed. But at that time, where the water was pulled out of the Thames, the same place that the human waste was deposited, you could see that there were really grounds for improvement. And another thing that where there was the way in which water was distributed then was through wooden pipes made out of trees. They bored a hole in a trunk of a tree and so on. And this was very inefficient because you couldn't get a high pressure without producing so many leaks and so on. And during the competition, iron pipes were introduced. People also tried pottery pipes and so on. There were various experiments made, but what one sees is that competition is not to be just regarded as the way in which people would compete with given methods of production, but it leads to the introduction of new ones. And of course, that was the weakness of the whole doctrine of the natural monopoly.
And so one of the puzzles, of course, that one has is, I take it historically you could measure rather tangible signs of improvement in water distribution under a competitive regime. Why then did it lose out politically, in your judgment?
Because the companies were interested in having what they called a districting arrangement.
So that each of them would have a local monopoly, essentially,
right,
by territory?
That's right. And so it was the New River Company, or the directors of the New River Company, that were most influential in getting this doctrine across. and John Stuart Mill in popularizing it.
So you have this peculiar alliance between intellectual socialists on the one hand and ground level monopolists on the other.
That's right.
And the poor, unorganized consumer was the one who suffered from that alliance?
That's right.
Now, was public utilities a mainstream subject in economics in the immediate post-world period, or were you off in some sort of byway?
I was off in some sort of byway, which had never been studied much. It was an American subject, and the textbooks we used were American. I found the study of public utilities very interesting, partly because nobody knew anything about it in Britain. And I wrote about the post office, for example.
And what did you conclude about it?
Well, it had several problems. One was a uniform price, for example. How did that come about? And I discussed how that came about and what its effects were.
And how did it come about?
Rowland Hill was the man who was responsible for the introduction of uniform postage. And he argued that previously the way in which postage had been paid is that when the letter was delivered, the person receiving it made the payment.
So you had to be home to take your mail?
You had to be willing to pay for it. If you didn't want to pay for it, you didn't get the letter. And they introduced at that time prepayment, a uniform system, which was supposed to be a cheaper way to administer it. Actually, the original proposal involved areas where the costs were higher, where there was a higher cost, even though uniform. But that got abandoned in the course of the parliamentary discussions.
Were these private companies or state companies that were delivering the mail?
Oh, it's always been state companies. And one of the things I went into is why was it the state got involved? And it's very easy to see why the state got involved. It wanted to control the distribution of information because it wanted to put down sedition. The origin of the monopoly, which finally got taken over in the United States, has nothing to do with economics and everything to do with politics.
And yet, did they ever exercise the power to exclude from the mail seditious activities and seditious letters, or is it a justification that was used to create the system and then sort of fell by the wayside during its operation?
No, people would look at the communications, and I'm sure quite a number of people lost their heads as a result of letters that were found.
Does this concern with sedition help explain why it was that the post office was intimately involved in the creation of and the control of the broadcast networks in Britain?
No, it isn't. What happened was I can't remember these dates exactly, but in the 1860s, it was decided that the various telegraph companies in England should be taken over and made a single operation operated by the state because it would be cheaper. Of course, it didn't prove to be cheaper, and it raised all sorts of other problems. For example, the employees of the telegraph companies became active in politics. Mm-hmm. It also was important in other respects. When the telephone was invented, the government, as it was operating the telegraph system, wanted the telephone companies to be hindered in their operations. So legislation was took place, which restricted the operations of the telephone. Anyway, the monopoly of the telegraph was given to the government operating in the post office. And a telegram was described as a message conveyed by electricity. When broadcasting came along, it was quite clear that what was involved was a telegram, because it was clearly a message conveyed by electricity, And in that way, the authority of the post office was established to control broadcasting.
So in your view, much of the history of the regulation of public utilities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in England had to do with the expansion of the post office, in which it controlled first the mail, then the telegraphs, and then the telephones.
That's right.
And then broadcasting to some extent, I suppose.
That's right.
Now, do you think this was a good or bad type of system, both in the terms of its merits and also how did it happen?
Well, the results were extremely bad. You had the telephone industry, which was hampered in its development by the need to protect the telegraph industry. And in the case of broadcasting, it was something quite different. It was that since you had defined a telegram as a message conveyed by electricity, broadcasting was therefore a telegram. The post office had powers to regulate it, which it exercised.
And how did it exercise those powers?
In granting licenses to people to operate.
And how did it decide who received the license?
It's a complicated story, but they finally decided that there should be a monopoly. The post office always wanted a monopoly. And the Marconi Company wanted a monopoly because it would be the dominant firm in that case. And so in England, when broadcasting started as a service, it started as a monopolized service. The British Broadcasting Company, as it was then.
And so this would reduce the range of choices and the level of innovations that were available to consumers?
Well, that was the whole idea, because the BBC, particularly after it became the British Broadcasting Corporation, a state enterprise, the idea was that the BBC gave people what they ought to have, and therefore you should prevent them getting broadcasts of a different sort.
So this ties into the very powerful anti-market theme that one of the reasons why markets are terrible is they satisfy the preferences that people actually have and reveal in their purchasing decisions?
Particularly the lower classes, because the educated classes, on the whole, felt they got what they wanted from the British Broadcasting Corporation, and it was the lower classes that didn't get what they wanted.
So essentially, a lot of the times when you studied public utilities, it became a lesson to you in the dangers associated with government-sponsored and organized
monopolies. That's
right, monopolies.
That's right.
And it's a lesson which we could continue to learn today, I suppose.
Well, I think so, but my change of view, which came gradually, was just through finding out how things operated, rather than some philosophical argument and so on.
That's right. In other words, you never did start from a proposition that in a just society what you wanted to do is to minimize the use of force and fraud. That would never have been an equation or a proposition that would have crossed your mind.
Never entered my mind.
And so essentially it was just watching a series of ad hoc adjustments and seeing which ones worked and which ones did not.
Yeah,
eventually
right.
Led you to believe that certain forms of industrial arrangements were better than others.
That's right.
So why don't you tell us a little bit what happened to you as England got sucked into the war? Were you able to keep up, formally or informally, with any of your own professional work during that period of time by reading or by writing?
Not really, no. It so happened that some of the things came into the ken of our work. For example, as the war approached, the economic section began, as the end of the war approached, the economic section began thinking, what should we policy be at the end of after the war was over?
And this would be the battle over centralized planning?
Not really. It discussed such things as how prices should be set, and that's where marginal cost pricing came in. It was involved with the National Health Service. It was involved with the policy towards full employment and such like.
And I take it, in fact, in part, the reason you wrote The Marginal Cost Controversy, although you wrote it before the war, was in response to the idea that you could identify a superior way to supply goods to governments in industries where there was decreasing marginal cost.
That's right. But it's also true that if you studied the tariffs of utilities, say electricity, they commonly used a two-part tariff. That is to say, they were willing to charge for additional units at approximately marginal cost while covering at the same time average costs by the two-part tariff. And what had happened was the economists discussing this, Mead and Fleming and Lerner
Hotelling.
And Hotelling, really had not thought that there was any other way except to have subsidies from the government.
Now, why is it that the two-part tariff is common to everybody who's seen a telephone in service, right?
That's right.
Now, why is it that something which everybody uses on a day-to-day basis would elude the attention of the greatest economists of the time?
Well, the audience of economists are other economists, and therefore there's no way in which you can get new insights coming in from studying how the economic system works, because that isn't the way economists work.
So part of the advantage of having a commerce and business background was that it exposed you to these real-world phenomena.
Yes, and you can see it very clearly in the United States at the present time. Where is the interesting work going on? It's not going on in the economics departments. It's going on in business schools, in law schools, in engineering schools.
And so anyhow, could you summarize for benefit of the audience exactly what your argument was in the marginal cost controversy?
Oh, I had come across this not through Mead's work and the work in the economic section of the War Cabinet Office, but with Abba Lerner. Mm-hmm. Abba Lerner was a great advocate of marginal cost pricing. And the argument for it is, if it costs $10 to produce another unit, it is absurd to think in terms of average cost, which is much higher. You should let people have it at $10.
Because the alternative is you're precluding people who would otherwise buy something from enjoying it.
That's right. And you're better off. What is the cost of the other resources, how the other resources would be used? And you were much better off by charging a price equal to marginal cost.
But and if marginal cost was zero, that meant giving the good away?
Exactly. Why not? Then you'd have to have some sort of lump sum payment in order to consume. Well, that's a possibility that was never considered.
How you raise the lump sum?
Well, they were always raising it through taxation, ignoring the fact that if they raised it through taxation, you'd raise the price above marginal cost.
For some other goods.
For some other good, that's right.
So that what happens is the marginal cost analysis only works if you consider a single good in isolation.
That's right.
But there is no way to consistently apply that policy with respect to all goods in society at all times. So that's the basic intuition. Now, all of this then, after you did the marginal cost controversy paper and so forth and published that, you then spent your time getting involved in the study of the British broadcasting system, correct?
It went on simultaneously, largely before the war, but completed after the war.
And, you know, you mentioned, or at least one of the concerns that you said, is that monopoly is not only important with respect to its economic characteristics, but also with respect to its political implications, with
yes.
respect to speech and foreign policy. How did that sort of manifest itself in connection with the BBC?
Well, the BBC produced the programs that Englishmen ought to hear. The way I used to put it was the BBC's, the Englishman's home is the BBC's castle. Mm-hmm. And that was accepted, that the BBC had a right to determine what people heard.
What did you find to be the most frequent arguments put forward in order to justify the monopoly, as if it needed some justification.
What would happen if you didn't have the monopoly? You'd have all these awful programs put on, which, you know, the masses would like, but which would really destroy their tastes and so on.
So it really was essentially the superior cultural attitude of the ruling classes
was
the dominant?
That's where the support came from. I don't think my book resulted in the setting up of the new system, but it helped acceptance of the transition.
And that took place in the 50s?
Yes.
And by that time, you wrote this book and then you split and you came to the United States? Is that basically what happened? And how did that come about, that you decided in 1950 or 51 to come to America?
Well, there were many reasons why I wanted to come to America. One, I hadn't much faith in the future of socialist Britain, something I think which has been justified. And furthermore, I admired the work of some American economists, particularly Frank Knight and George Stigler.
And I guess the next major piece of work that you did was the one on the federal communications system.
That's right.
And when you did that, I take it you were at Stanford at the Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences?
That's right.
So what was the environment like there, and how did it conduce to the production of this wonderful paper?
Oh, well, it was very nice. You had no teaching duties. You could just work away. And my work on the FCC was essentially a continuation of the sort of work I was doing on broadcasting in England.
Now, how did you research that article? Did you go down to Washington, read administrative hearings, speak to industry people, or just sit around at the Center for Advanced Studies in Palo Alto and think about it?
At that stage, I was just in Palo Alto thinking about it, and of course, most of the hearings and deliberations of the FCC are public,
mm-hmm.
and so you don't really need to go there. And as regards speaking to people, I had spoken to people at the FCC in 1948,
mm-hmm.
and I knew what their views were.
And how do those views differ from those which were adopted, for example, by the BBC?
Oh, the BBC was, in a sense, the idol of these people. That's what they wanted to create in America.
I mean, that kind of monopoly? But I thought at that time
it wouldn't be done through a monopoly. It would be done by the FCC controlling programming,
mm-hmm.
requiring people to broadcast this sort of thing as part of the license. And when it came out, it was regarded as ridiculous in many quarters.
Well, what was it that was so upsetting? This was the privatization argument with respect to frequencies?
That's right.
Now, on that question, there is an interesting subplot. How would you create the frequencies? Would you decide to let people, whatever the frequencies were administratively created, have them bought and sold, or would you allow people
to... Well, that's a start.
Mm-hmm. What else might you do to get them more efficient?
You might allow people then to modify through contract use of the frequencies and so on.
So they could subdivide it into small units?
Or join them up or do whatever they want. And in fact, there is a proposal at the moment to do that for certain frequencies.
So in other words, what happens is a frequency which is now designated for broadcasting could, by its buyer, be put to use for personal cell phone communication if you so choose.
That's right.
The way when I buy your house, it's not as though I'm obliged to keep the living room in exactly the same place that you kept it and so forth.
And there's a possibility that this may happen for certain frequencies, and I hope it does.
When you did this paper on the FCC, you announced a proposition that the ultimate use of a frequency, be it a radio station on the one hand or a cave on the other, I think was the example, did not depend upon who owned it, but on what was its highest value
That's
use.
That's right.
Now, how did you stumble across what now becomes known as the Coase theorem when you were doing all of this work?
Well, because I said this in the FCC paper, thinking I was making a proposition of the kind that 2 and 2 equals 4. I mean, it's obvious that... if you look out of the window, the land isn't being used for growing wheat. It's so obvious that I don't understand why there's been any fuss about it.
Suppose somebody were to say, that's because what you did is you forced people to think about a zero transactions cost world, and they didn't know whether that was a world of fantasy or a world of approximate reality.
I don't think it has anything to do with that. And for this reason, I think what they thought was, suppose you have a question whether you're liable for damage caused or not. They thought, if you're liable for damage caused, your costs are higher than if you're not. But they ignore the fact that the person causing the damage would pay you not to stop him. And therefore, the costs are really exactly the same in the two situations. It's only looking at it one way, not both ways. And the fact that you can in fact, follow what I said is shown in the fact that we now have trading in allowances to pollute.
Mm-hmm. Now, when one starts to think about these things, which are obvious but not obvious within the profession, do you think that it's just an accident that you were the fellow who pushed this line the hardest, that you were also a fellow who never studied economics as an undergraduate, never spent your time in mathematics of economics, and never got a PhD in the field? So that you would be utterly unqualified, for example, if you went into the market today. Do you think that you were benefited by the lack of education?
Oh, I think so, because not being trained to think in a certain way, I hadn't been trained not to think in a certain way. Therefore, I was free to tackle the problems.
And when you turned and tackled this problem in the article, The Problem of Social Cost, you spent a huge amount of your time worrying about 19th century English nuisance cases. Did you think that's because the doctrine only applied to nuisance cases, or is it the easiest way to analyze it?
I use those purely as illustrations. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the only place where you could find discussions of real problems was in the law cases, because they weren't in the economics literature.
Now, do you think, in effect, the common law rules were relatively efficient, given all that you know about the system of costs and benefits associated with trading and associated with resource use?
I would think so. The great advantage of these cases is that the two parties are there.
Mm-hmm.
And a judge can't ignore the fact that if he's doing this here, it's going to affect the people over there. And you have to compare the two things.
Yeah, and some of the cases became very subtle, like, for example, with Sturgis and Bridgman.
It's an interesting case because you had this man, I can't remember which is Bridgman.
Doesn't
which
matter.
Is
you had an apothecary or a druggist on the one side.
Yes, there was a confectioner on the other, and his pounding and so on affected the operations of the doctor. Well, it's a nice case.
What was interesting is that the doctor was there for a long period of time, working in perfect peace and harmony until the confectioner came next door and started his equipment up. Now, do you think, in effect, the other thing that struck lawyers about your article was that they had spent a huge amount of time developing a theory of causation on which they could make responsibility turn? And then you wrote an article and in three or four pages announced that all doctrines of causation are reciprocal.
That's right. Both sides are the cause, mm-hmm. If you're going to talk in those terms. You can't say... if the doctor wasn't there, there'd be no harm.
Mm-hmm. And if the confectioner wasn't there, there'd be no harm.
Exactly.
So all you need to have a causation question is a conflict of interest.
That's right. And you say... which is the greater harm, to stop this or to stop that?
But I take your general worldview to be that given the levels of uncertainty that we have about the organization of an economic system, stress on system, that our chief objective ought to be to reduce the level of transactions
cost
in order to allow markets to clear.
Absolutely.
And that's the Coasean view says, optimistically, if we reduce the transactions cost, the markets will indeed clear.
And therefore, one's endeavors ought to be to reduce transaction costs,
rather than to figure out what the right ultimate allocation of resources should be.
The gain we get in a functioning economic system comes through the lowering of transaction costs. And I think we can see this with the internet and the new means which enable information to be obtained more easily than before.
And therefore allow the more efficient sorting of goods and persons across markets. Do you think, as I do, that there is a consistent worldview that links your early writings on the nature of the firm with the problem of social cost and just about everything that goes between it?
It's become clearer what I meant.
How is that so?
Well, because I understand the thing a little better than I did. When you get an idea, it's in a crude sort of form. You know, you talk about the costs of using the market, but you're not very clear exactly what it is. As time goes by, you understand a little better. And I think I understand a little better, but not as much as I'd like to.
Now, in terms of its influence, you said in your Nobel talk, if I recall, that the influence of the problem of social cost was immense with lawyers, but not with economists. Can you explain to us exactly what that means? I take it I got you about right on that.
Well, certainly you can see that in citations. The lawyers said, ah, yes, this is a good idea, and they tried to use it. Mm-hmm. The economists, some of them said it was a good idea, and some of them said it was a bad idea, and they quarreled. When lawyers are dealing with specific problems, this is just my impression from the literature, they do use the ideas there. Mm-hmm. Economists haven't much used it, and yet they ought to, because, again, if we go back to Adam Smith, Adam Smith said that division of labor or specialization is the basis for increased production.
In the market.
That's right. And lower transaction costs enable one to have more specialization, therefore more production.
Either by firms or by spot transactions.
By whoever it is. Mm-hmm. And so our standard of living really depends to a large extent on the level of transaction costs. So we ought to be interested in it.
I have to confess, that's the way I teach my property and contracts courses.
Well, you may not need to change, but most economists do. You don't find in an economics textbook an argument of this sort.
To some extent, you try to infuse the world with the view of the centrality of transactions cost when you were editor of the Journal of Law and Economics.
I use the opportunity for publication in the Journal of Law and Economics as an incentive to people, because people want to publish, but and if they know there's a chance of it being published, they'll do the work, which otherwise they wouldn't do. And I use the law and economics program to bring people as fellows to do studies. And I commissioned articles. I was
a regular entrepreneur. Right?
I was active in using the journal, and we had lots of splendid articles as a result.
Now, in terms of this, while you were at the Journal of Law and Economics, you also did some of your own studies, and I guess two of them come to mind, and I'd like you to comment on both. The first was the one about the place of the lighthouse and how you think that that's relevant. And the second one, which is more theoretical, was on durable monopolies. Let's start with the lighthouse.
Well, Samuelson had used this as a prime example of a public good which had to be supplied by the government. And I don't know how I knew it, but I knew it somehow, that this was not true for lighthouses, although he used the lighthouse as the example and at length and so on. So I went back and found out exactly how it worked in England and published the article and showed that what Samuelson had said was nonsense.
And what did you discover in your investigations?
I discovered that in England, for a couple of hundred years, maybe more. Lighthouses were built, financed, and owned by private individuals who could leave them to others, bequeath them in their wills, act like private property. And this was done by allowing them to collect tolls, in effect, on the ships presumed to have used the lighthouse.
And now, what was the mechanism that was used in order to collect the tolls?
Well, they had a right to collect the toll, and they were able to use that right whenever the ship came into port. It's difficult to enforce it when they weren't in port. And they employed agents for this purpose. Most of the agents turned out to be customs officials who, because they had to board the ships and so on, could carry out this extra duty without too much trouble.
Now, how did the lighthouse companies get the right to collect the tolls from the people when they came into port?
They got it through a license from the government.
So in other words, to that extent, they were privately owned but government licensed. So it's not a question of pure private ownership.
Well, it never is. Who devises the property rights that people are to own?
Not always the state at some level.
The state in some ways involved. You can get these private schemes of which Lisa Bernstein talks about and others, but that requires a relatively small, specialized group. And if you're going to make a rule for people all over the United States, it's very hard for them to get together to do that.
But it's
except through the government.
But it's only in this. One of the interesting things is with the lighthouse, one of the things that the government had to give you was the right to collect the tolls, where normally they don't give the business the right to get fees from customers. And that was because without the ability to collect, everybody would just simply walk away from the good which was provided, whether they needed it or not, right?
But you know, you think of copyright and patents and other forms of property. Which are created by the government, but we don't think of them as not involving private property.
No, it's clear, but it's private property in somewhat of a mixed system. And the issue is, what's the rate of the mixture? And it's relatively little. Now, the one question, again, I think that's instructive about the lighthouse is, these things became taken over by the government for their operation somewhere in the 1830s, correct?
That's right.
Now, what was the political economy which led to their takeover?
Well, there was a belief that the charge, the toll, would be lower under the new system than the old.
Was it correct or wrong, as it worked out in practice?
In practice, the lighthouse fees did go down, but they went down in the same way that tolls on the Chicago tollways are going to go down, because the debt had been paid off.
And what about durable monopolies? This is a much more technical paper.
Yes.
And yet, can you describe very briefly what it's about?
Well, economists have often been discussing how you price a durable good. And some people had argued that it was in the interests of the monopolists to make the good less durable. And in fact, one of the people who did that was Milton Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this article and showed that in fact it was in the interests of a monopolist to make his product less durable. It was very strange to me. It's the only article that I've ever written because I thought if I didn't do it, someone else would take my idea and also publish it.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to put forward this view at workshops and at lunch, and people just get their eyes glazed over. What people would do in a workshop is to go in and say, this is the demand for a durable good. They show a normal demand schedule. And I'd then butt in and say, how can you draw a demand for a durable good, unless you know what they're going to do in future.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't understand that for some reason.
And the future choices would be either to use it or to sell it?
No. What conditions you would put on it. The example I use, suppose you owned all the land in the United States, mm-hmm. at what price would you sell it? Well, you say the monopoly price would be yielded if you sold half the land in the United States. You say that, and people would think that was right. But then I would raise the question, what do you do with the other half? Mm-hmm. After you've sold the first half, it's in your interest to sell the next half, and so on, if you took half of that. And so you cannot really discuss the price at which a monopoly producing durable goods sells its durable good unless you can talk about what happens afterwards.
I mean,
through time.
Whether they subject the land originally sold to restrictions against
resale.
That's
right.
And if they do, then that would reduce the amount that they could charge at the front end, but increase the value of their retained stock.
That's right. And people didn't understand this. So I pointed out in the durable goods article the various devices people use. They make a guarantee they won't produce more than mm-hmm. a certain amount, or they make an offer to buy it back at the price.
At a fixed price.
In the case of land, I suggested another way they could do it was give it to the federal government. Then it wouldn't be used. And that would be a guarantee. Well, you've got to discuss the problem of the pricing of durable goods in terms of the contractual arrangements that can be made. And these aren't the terms that the economists are used to discussing it.
You know, it's interesting. It seems to me, again, to tie back to all the earlier work that you've done, because it's always the system that matters, never the individual case alone. So if you're trying to figure out the price at which you could sell the goods that you wish to get rid of, you must understand what's going to happen to them in a future period and also what's going to happen to the stock that remains with the original seller.
Yes.
And to try and figure out one portion of this problem without taking into the whole is wrong. And indeed, I think, isn't that sort of a part of your general theory that all price theory starts as very kind of local equilibrium and ends up as really being a general equilibrium theory, whether you like it or not? That you have to understand all parts moving simultaneously before any part becomes intelligible.
I think that's right, but of course you limit the interactions that you consider at any time. In the case of the monopoly of a durable good, there are lots of other things you don't have to think about, and you can instance the type of action that it would take. But one way of making sure that your good doesn't last into the future and guarantees that the price can be kept up is to make it less durable. And that runs against Milton's point.
You did overlap with Milton Friedman in Chicago for 12 years. What were your sort of interactions with him?
Not great, because his interest was in the monetary system and so on, and policy, whereas basically mine was not. But our relations were always very cordial, and he was very nice. And he wasn't very pleased with the fact that I attacked the methodology of positive economics.
Now, this is his famous 1953 essay?
Yes.
And how did you precisely attack it?
He says that you should base your theories on the accuracy of its predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that you can't do it.
Because?
Until you know the predictions, you wouldn't know what theory to adopt. But you wouldn't go looking for the predictions unless you had a theory to test. So the theory, your view on theory, comes before the predictions.
And then what happens is you get new
data. I said if you followed Milton's view, you get no new theories, because you get no predictions. I follow really Kuhn's point here, mm-hmm. that you don't find out anything unless you're looking for it.
And then when you're looking for it, you may find things where lesser minds would just overlook it.
You might, but by and large, you have an idea that this might be so mm-hmm. before you look, and then you look, and then if it works out, you feel pretty happy and feel it was vindicated. But the idea that you have to know the predictions before you adopt a theory is, in my view, just to say you're not going to have any new theories.
And so the question is, if you had to give advice to a young economist, age 21, in the year 2001, what would you tell him to look at and why?
I would say just look around and find a problem, and then try and tackle it. Not to start off with knowing your techniques of analysis and all that sort of stuff, and then look around for a problem to use it on, which is the way economists are normally trained these days. And we live in a gold mine. Mm-hmm. We're full of problems. So I just go into the street and find the problems.
And then the trick is to try to find a pervasive insight that explains a commonplace phenomenon that everybody has overlooked but has to understand.
That's all you have to do.
So in other words, you have to find the next transactions cost in order to be able to mine the appropriate gold.
Yes, but I'm sure that when people have found it, we'll think it's obvious.
On behalf of the Liberty Fund, and indeed on my own behalf, I'd like to thank you very much for having this conversation with us this afternoon, and wonder if you have any parting words to say as we wrap up.
Well, I would hope that economists start off by studying real-world problems rather than the imaginary worlds that most economists seem to delight in.
A pragmatist and a realist to the end. Thank you.